Thanks for coming, Soccer Show. My name is Carter Krishnar. I'm joined, as always, by Neil Blackman. And we have a very special guest today, Richard Farley, veteran American soccer writer, most recently with 442. He's transitioning to some new projects that he'll be announcing in the near future. Unfortunately, can't announce today. But glad to have Richard with us to discuss Jonathan Gonzalez and the state of American soccer. Richard, thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thanks. It's also cool to be called very special. I think the last time I joined you guys, we talked about the NWSL season and ended up talking a lot about how I didn't think the Boston Breakers were actually that good. So I don't think we're going in that direction today, but it'll be interesting to, if we were imagine the topics on a spectrum, how far from that topic we're going to get today.
Yeah, so we're probably going to go a full 180 here and talk about Jonathan Gonzalez's decision to play for Mexico. We had reported, Neil had reported, Yankster Coming had reported a while ago that he was still strongly leaning towards the United States, but then there were some intervening events that took place between the time Neil reported that and his final decision last week that we can get into in a moment. But first, Richard, just want to get your initial take on this young man's decision.
Well, unfortunately, my take is going to sound like I don't have a take, but it is something that I thought about a lot, or I should say I thought about a lot a long time ago once I started really covering soccer and making it my profession. And in talking to a lot of these athletes and going through so many of these different situations dating back over a decade, my thoughts are basically, since I don't know this person, it's really hard for me to judge. And I think I have to take it as an article of faith that he's doing what's best for him. What best lines up with both his professional and personal identities. And given that I had know zero about either of those things, like most things with most people in life, I wish him luck and wish him the best and trust that he's doing what he thinks right now is best for himself.
So, Richard, on that score, personal identity is a complex issue. Your former 442 colleague and our friend Paul Tenorio, who both Neil and I respect immensely, tweeted something very very telling the other day about personal identity being more complicated than just saying, hey, I'm an American, or I'm a Mexican, or I'm a Honduran, or I'm a Nicaraguan, or what have you. I only have one passport. I have an American passport, but I am considered an overseas citizen of India, which gives me access to go back and forth without a visa. That's the essential thing it does. I do not have an Indian passport, but I can relate to that from my own personal experience, because as an American national of Indian heritage, it was very difficult for me to go back and forth as often as I want to go, which is basically once a year to India, without having to go through the visa process and pay money for the visa. So I finally applied for what we call an overseas citizen of India card, which just basically gives you, as a person of Indian heritage or of Indian blood, unlimited access to go back and forth as a citizen of another country, but someone who has paid taxes in India through various investments I have, and as well as my own personal heritage. So the identity thing is always very difficult for me, and I think, unfortunately, and love to get Neil to weigh in on this, a lot of American soccer fans have made it a black or white thing and have used this national team, for whatever reason, as a way to promote what I consistently call faux nationalism. But people who follow me on Twitter probably see me use that term.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think one of the things that happens is that it's one of the – not one of the things that happens, I guess. I'm already phrasing what I want to say wrong. I think part of international soccer that maybe some of us struggle with – and I say some of us just based on conversations I've had. I'm not trying to speak for you or Richard, but some of us struggle with this idea of the fact that when you enjoy international soccer, as a lot of us do, obviously you can't escape the nationalist element of it. And then there's all these things that sort of sometimes go hand in hand with nationalism that are unfortunate, right? So that's first. I can also say that, you know, having done a lot of reporting on this story over the past several months, I mean, this gets into the secondary thing related to that with international soccer, is that identities are really complex, and American identities not in particular, but there is a uniqueness about some aspects of American identities because it is a nation of immigrants. So what you have is a young man who, at least I'm not the only one that reported this, as recently as New Year's Eve, you know, was really conflicted about what to do. I don't know what all went into the process of that becoming ultimately his decision to play for Mexico or not. And I certainly don't judge that decision. I think we can look objectively at certain factors that might have influenced the decision. But anytime these things happen, you know, from a soccer perspective, there's an impact to it. And then there should be some questions asked about why. In this instance, at least in my opinion, because this is someone that had played for all our youth teams and that was really, really struggling with the idea of not playing for the United States as recently as a couple weeks ago.
Let me ask you guys both this, and maybe Richard answer this first because Richard's covered the game just about all over the world. Part of it for me, and I keep having to throw out this on Twitter and on social media and just get lampooned by the fringe elements, but as Richard pointed out to me in a private conversation not long ago, it wasn't as bad with Gonzalez as it was with Rossi, that fringe, or with Subotic. So maybe we're getting more mature about this, but how much of this comes down to the fact that a top-level professional footballer who is not Zlatan or Cristiano Ronaldo has 3 or 4 years at the very top level? I mean, we're seeing, for example, since we're talking about Mexico and the U.S., Irving Lozano enter that window now, and 4 or 5 years from now, he'll be on the descent in all likelihood. So you have a short shelf life, and in the case of Jonathan Gonzalez, to get the appropriate moves from a club standpoint to get him to a bigger club, perhaps in Europe, if only he wants to leave out of Liga MX, maybe at this point in time, it's more advantageous professionally to be a Mexican international than a U.S. international. I know it's a very tough thing for nationalists and people who try and boil this down to very simplistic identity ideas to understand, but maybe this is a decision based around his club career and on the advice of his agent, perhaps.
I think it's interesting that we at least address these possibilities and at least talk about the fact that professional concerns can be a major factor in these decisions for individuals. For some, they don't. They aren't a factor. For some, the nationalistic or the national identity part of them outweighs everything else. But for other people, particularly those that might have allegiances to more than one country, these other things end up serving as tiebreakers. And I really think the conversation that we have around these issues a lot of times not only fails to acknowledge that, but also fails to acknowledge that sporting identity for a lot of people is very distinct from personal identity. And somebody can, in their private life, identify themselves one way, while in their professional life, identify themselves another. And I think that all these things need to be considered. In general, we need to consider that the idea of identity on all of these levels are things that each individual person has agency over. They get to define what that means to them. It makes it very difficult to then draw conclusions about situations like Jonathan Gonzalez, the other two that you alluded to, and also situations that have gone in the way of the United States, be it the slew of ex-German internationals that applied for one switches under Jurgen Klinsmann, or people that very early on in their career made decisions similar to Christian Pulisic. I don't think that any of these decisions are right or wrong. I just think from our perspective, be it as fans or be it as people covering the game, it's an injustice to simplify these things and not act like these aren't very complex, very ranging, and ultimately very unknowable decisions for these players.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that's it's a great point both of you bring up in terms of one factor I left out in an article I wrote was the club considerations and maybe what types of professional considerations are a factor. Kind of glossed over that and made, you know, a separate argument that simply rooted in international soccer, which was just that, you know, you only get so many World Cups, and the U.S. not qualifying for a World Cup was probably something that shaped some of the decision. Again, and Richard's right, because the person with the agency over the decision, fortunately, is Jonathan Gonzalez. So, you know, I don't know how much, you know, the United States not being in the World Cup had to do with that. What I can say is that, you know, he certainly has said, and family members have told multiple sources that I think are trusted sources that have then reported these things, that, you know, the fact that he was continually left out while the U.S. searched for midfield answers in the hex probably had something to do with it. And then you talk about the platform that a World Cup provides a club career as kind of being something that is also related to that. That's a damaging thing as well. So, you know, one thing that I thought was reductionist that was happening, at least initially when the story broke, was this idea that, well, the U.S. didn't call him into a friendly in Portugal, so that's why. And I think that does a disservice not only to the young man, but it's just how complex these decisions are. I don't think this was about a friendly against Portugal in November.
I think Neil makes some interesting points, and I think one thing that I take from that, or I'm reminded of, is that whenever we see decisions like Jonathan Gonzalez's, we tend to think that that decision mostly reflects or tells us something about the person who made the decision. And while it's certainly true, it does tell us something. In this case, and I think in other cases, the Subotic case really comes to mind, what it really probably tells us is more about the federations involved or the processes that go into essentially recruiting these players when it comes to situations like this. It lets us know about the relationships that are built, relationships that aren't built, how important those relationships were to the player. And I think, like Neil just said, it's important not to pretend like those relationships are only 2 or 3 months old. In the case of Jonathan Gonzalez, we have a pretty good idea about how far back this relationship goes. And we're also finding out how far back the relationship doesn't go. There's been a lot of talk about things like Alianza football and things like that, and how little attention that the Federation has given efforts like that to try to bring more players to the spotlight, be it U.S. soccer or mostly with Alianza, Mexican soccer. That seems to be the place where those type of initiatives are being taken advantage of most. But when we see, I mean, you see it a lot on social media, of course, and you see it a lot in coverage, too. When you see Jonathan Gonzalez make a decision like this, there tends to be this part of the conversation that leans towards, well, I guess he just feels that Mexican. I don't know that it tells us anything about that. It could, but there are so many other factors that go into this that it's a little bit dangerous, I think, to assume that this decision says anything about how Jonathan Gonzalez sees himself or anything new about how Jonathan Gonzalez sees himself.
On the Alianza thing, I just want to throw in a point before we continue that a lot has been made of that, and the Federation, it is correct, has not given it perhaps the consideration and due that they should. However, I know of several USL teams that have sent scouts to Alianza events in the last 2 years. So I don't know of any MLS teams, in fairness, right, but I do know of several USL teams that are looking for bargain priced players who are either U.S. citizens or have a green card or some sort of legal status in the U.S. that they can register as domestic players. So it's not that the entire rank of professional soccer has overlooked this, as has been implied. I just wanted to throw that out there.
That's true. And I also, I guess, when I mentioned the Federation, I don't think everybody from within the Federation doesn't see the value in something like Alianza also. I think that particularly in the midst of this presidential campaign, U.S. presidential campaign, we tend to say things like MLS or the Federation as if those things are monoliths or together they're the same thing, and they're not. There have been definitely people from very high up on the technical side in U.S. soccer that have attended some of the showcases and camps that Alianza have held. I think it's very interesting, though, that those people tend to not want to let it be known that they are there and trying to find talent, because as it's no surprise to everybody on this call, the Federation has not only failed to utilize programs like Alianza, but tend to take an approach that it's something that not only exists outside of U.S. soccer, but would be better if those players were just funneled straight into U.S. soccer.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's fascinating to me that I thought is sort of a secondary issue to this story, but but not a totally insignificant one, or else I wouldn't waste anyone's time with putting it in the podcast, is this idea that, you know, the United States made this decision to let Dave Sarachin manage this team on an interim basis, at least in terms of whatever happens in January and whatever happens after that, and probably, you know, if most reports are and speculation is correct, at least until the spring, and then we'll see what happens when they travel to Europe for some inevitable games around that time. And so what they did when they made that decision was they chose a person, whether willfully or not, who is one of the people within the Federation who hasn't really been around Alianza, who hasn't really been around some of these other programs that emphasize the development of Latino American talents. What you have is, you know, you had options like John Hackworth, who were on the payroll and could have managed the team, who were sort of attendant to those possibilities, and U.S. Soccer went in a different direction for whatever reason. And again, I'm not trying to say that that's something that, you know, also caused Jonathan Gonzalez's decision. I don't know that. What I do know is that from an optics perspective, that seems to sort of be interesting. And that was maybe the biggest bombshell to me of the interview that Mike was on today, Soccer America, was this idea that only three people with affiliations in the Federation at any point in time had gone out to that Alianza camp, Bob Bradley, John Hackworth, and I'm forgetting who the third person was. That was kind of astonishing to me. I don't know if anyone else saw it.
Yeah, I think, though, it's important to dial it back a little bit with the Dave Sarachin appointment. The dilemma for Sunil Gulati when Bruce Arena was let go was, do you hire a manager, a younger manager who's American from Major League Soccer, or even bump up a guy like Hackworth from the U.S.?
Hello?
Yeah, so I kind of understand the dilemma from Sunil Gulati, right? When Sarachin was appointed and was bumped up to this interim position, you have a situation where you don't want to give the job temporarily to someone who might have designs on the job long term. Even a John Hackworth managing the U-17 level, or a coach in your system, a Tab Ramos, or an MLS manager, or a manager who's recently left MLS, like Dom Kinnear. You want to have a clean slate. So, again, I think the interpretations of now saying that and it's not you, Neil, it's people out there saying, well, if we had appointed someone else as the caretaker manager rather than Dave Sarachin, this wouldn't have happened. Well, it was absolutely the right decision, in my opinion. Dave Sarachin's a guy that's earned his stripes. He's a guy who's earned his way. He's been on the coaching staffs of Chicago and Los Angeles and D.C. United at times where they've won a lot of things and knows the domestic soccer scene just about as well as anyone. So I think if you're going to keep a continuum going and not hand it over to someone who might then try to maneuver their way into the job permanently, giving you another 4 years of a problem – you've already had come off of 3 or 4 years of inadequate results. Then you make this appointment. It's a pity if it contributed to the situation, but I think that it is what it is. So you know, moving on from the Sarachin issue, what are your folks' thoughts about? And we'll start with you, Richard. Your thought about the situation where the United States now finds itself losing battles for dual nationals that they were winning when Jurgen Klinsmann was the manager. Now, I have a lot of critiques, as does Neil, about Jurgen Klinsmann, the manager, the man manager, the tactical manager. But as a technical director and scout for talent and a visionary, there's little to question in his thought process. Has the U.S. become less attractive to dual nationals because Jurgen Klinsmann isn't the manager?
I mean, it would be difficult for anybody to refute that given the track record of Jurgen Klinsmann. I think that, like you alluded to, is one of the parts of Jurgen Klinsmann's contribution to U.S. soccer that seems to be pretty undeniable, his ability to get these people who are on the fence to
to commit to the United States, or maybe people that were playing in places where U.S. soccer hadn't been able to identify or cultivate them. He went out and seemed to make it a point of pride to get them in. So merely Jurgen Klinsmann, maybe that doesn't make the U.S. doesn't make U.S. soccer suddenly bad at convincing dual potential, well, people with dual allegiances to play for U.S. soccer, but maybe it regresses them to the mean, so to speak.
Yeah.
But I think it would also be foolish to ignore a lot of people who have pointed out that the Federation just doesn't seem to be in as good a place as it was, even going back to 2010 or 2009. The prestige has gone a little bit, and maybe in the U.S.'s success rate in convincing a lot of people who have options to play for the United States, maybe that has helped other countries up their game a little bit. I think that's one thing that we might want to consider with the Jonathan Gonzalez situation, that maybe Mexico just did a very good job, a better job than it had before. Maybe that has something to do with Jonathan Gonzalez's stature and how he's played for the last year at club level. But we might also want to consider that this may be, although it is a failure in absolute terms, this might be a failure because Mexico has stepped up its game, not so much the United States has gotten worse at this. So I know I kind of said two different things there, you know, that Klinsmann leaving alone, Klinsmann not being there probably makes the U.S. worse at convincing people who have choices to make the choice of the U.S. But at the same time, we might want to acknowledge that maybe competitors are just getting better at winning these battles that the U.S. tend to pick before.
Yeah, before.
Yeah.
Sorry, Neil.
No,
just real quickly.
No, that's okay.
In historical context, just want to point out that we had some body blows as American soccer fans and with Giuseppe Rossi and Nevin Subotic, and the psychological effect. Richard mentioned 2009. The psychological effect of Jermaine Jones switching from Germany to the United States was immense. It was tremendous, and it perhaps was the thing that opened the floodgates toward the dual nationals that Klinsmann then recruited. And Jones obviously more than earned his keep with his performances for the national team over the however many years he was in the squad, 7 years or so, so 6 or 7 years. But go ahead.
Of course. Well, no, I was going to say I actually agree with what Richard said, and I think there's one thing that kind of compounds it, but I can buttress it with some evidence just from my own reporting, which was that, look, when Gonzalez had the chance to play for Club America, very well could have signed with them and opted to play with Rayados, which, you know, is usually an indicator that he didn't necessarily, at least at the time, see his future with the Mexican national team, because America is where you go if traditionally when you're cultivating a young player for, you know, future performance with L3. So I think that was one thing that Mexico then became cognizant of that, and was based on what I was told by sources at Monterrey this week, last week now, were always around Gonzalez over the last year, and increasingly so in the last 5 to 6 months, particularly after the U.S. failed to qualify for the World Cup. So I think that last little part, after the U.S. failed to qualify for the World Cup, was certainly also probably damaging to the United States in a recruiting battle as well. The other thing is, I just think that the leadership of Bruce Arena compounded it, which is why, I think it was obvious why they brought Bruce in, and it made a good deal of sense at the time. But I think the failure to call Gonzalez in, even for a Gold Cup, where they did call multiple Liga MX players, where Juan Carlos Osorio used almost exclusively Liga MX players from Mexico. Other countries used their Liga MX players, and here was one of, you know, these players that was becoming a rising star there that was not invited. So you have that sort of slight coupled with the way that Bruce Arena handled and treated Fabian Johnson, another dual international down the stretch. And so that gets us into what I think is maybe the important touchstone conversation of Jonathan Gonzalez. What do we do now? Are there ways in which U.S. either neglects or delegitimizes dual nationals? And what do we do to increase access to these sorts of underserved and marginalized communities in U.S. soccer? Because my sense is that even if it's a regression to the mean, the U.S., you know, is going to continue to slide on these fronts unless they address some of these core issues. But regardless of the agency reasons that Gonzalez made the decision, you know, what was fascinating were the reports from family members telling sources it shouldn't have been complicated for Jonathan, but it became complicated. Well, why?
Yeah, I think that you touched on some things that we shouldn't dance around with, too. We have this thing where as we evolve in our society and we evolve in our ideas about what diversity and inclusiveness means, a lot of the language of the older generation starts to be picked apart and really seized upon by people my age and younger. And there were multiple times where Bruce Arena fell into that. I mean, you guys were on Twitter at the times where Bruce Arena would say something and it left it open as to whether he was being exclusionary to people from that were maybe spent time in other countries. I think that, you know, the German nationals that joined the team when Jurgen Klinsmann came on board seemed to be the people he was alluding to when he would say things without question certain players' commitments. And combine that with the increasingly nationalistic fervor in this country beyond sports, I think it is interesting to wonder how much these things place U.S. soccer in a different context when it comes to players like Jonathan Gonzalez. And then if you add into that some obvious missteps that the Federation makes, specific, I'm alluding only to the Jonathan Gonzalez case here, and you have a totally different context and a totally different atmosphere around these players' decisions. You know, at one time during the last cycle, there are people who elected to join the United States that are going to be forgotten as to how big of a catch that they were. I mean, the idea that Mix Discarude and Aaron Johansson chose the United States, people are going to look back at those things and just not even consider them as a big deal. But when they happened, they were a big deal. And right. those were big gets for the program. And
Johansson now loses a larger get because, I mean, he's missing a World Cup because he chose the U.S., right?
Right.
I mean, Iceland qualified for this World Cup. The U.S. didn't.
Yeah, possibly, but at the same time, if the U.S. makes the World Cup, does Arenas make the same kind of decisions with his World Cup roster that he made with his qualifying roster, which was basically to rely on, I think personally his bias is just towards player things he saw a lot in MLS, period, and that his bias is less towards thinking that American identity means that you grew up in this culture than towards players that he's just sure about and that he saw, that he saw a lot, he's familiar to. However, it's kind of important to acknowledge that there is an attitude within some people in our soccer culture, and it reflected sometimes in Bruce Arena's comments, I happen to think unintentionally, that you're not really an American player unless you were brought up here in a... We need to come to grips with the tension that has been out there, that was reflected in Arena's words. There are a lot of people with logical reasons that I happen to reject that think that players that play for the United States that weren't groomed by U.S. soccer culture are somehow not reflective of U.S. soccer and therefore shouldn't be representing U.S. soccer.
Can I play devil's advocate here for a minute, Richard? Because I don't think
I'm about to play devil's advocate.
Okay, go ahead. You're probably going to make the point I was going
to
ask.
I don't think that is fair to the players, the players under the umbrella that U.S. soccer is supposed to represent. It's not Jermaine Jones or Fabian Johnson's or any of these other players' duty to be more American for other people's standards of Americanness. And it's not Jonathan Gonzalez's duty to spend his formative years in an MLS academy rather than going to Mexico. I don't know if people would eventually look at Jonathan Gonzalez as groomed by another soccer culture, had he the United States, but I think as a culture we need to acknowledge that we're very loose with our language and we start bringing these conversations into the center of our culture, it does reasonably lead other people to conclude that there's a certain type of Americanness we want in our athletes, and some athletes that should be represented by U.S. soccer or should be eligible to represent U.S. soccer end up outside of that picture.
But let me ask you guys this. If we are trying to develop our own style of play, our own soccer culture, would it be best if our guys that were in the national team program all started in a DA academy or a Major League Soccer academy, played a year or two of professional soccer in this country before they moved abroad if it best suited their development needs, rather than picking and choosing guys who develop in different systems, because then you can never develop a common style or a common understanding of one another in a dressing room and the kind of chemistry you need as a team. I don't subscribe to that, but there are people who've made that argument. They'll use Italy, who's now failed to qualify for a World Cup, I know. But previous Italy teams is an example of where they essentially chose players who had come through a similar style of development, were playing in the domestic league. If guys went to Spain or England, often they weren't chosen. Lippi's team in 2006 was entirely Serie A-based, and they won a World Cup. Is that the way to go, or do you think that in this more cosmopolitan world we have to just be diverse and inclusive?
Can't you solve that problem just by having the youth national teams sort of play a similar, or if not the same, you know, tactical way? Can't you solve some of it with that? My concern would then be, like, what happens to a Fabian Johnson who, you know, I can tell you from my own reporting, was crushed by his omission from the roster in October. You know, what happens to a kid that grows up on a military base that's not really it's not really an option for him to come back and join FC Dallas's academy, right?
This is a perfect opportunity. Let me throw this out there, because you're reporting right after the Panama game. Or sorry, not the Panama game, the Trinidad game. Your interview with Fabian Johnson, I think, is a benchmark in this discussion, and I would encourage everybody to read it. There is an impression among some American soccer fans when they see a guy grew up in Germany that they grew up in a German culture. In many cases, I've spent a lot of time in Germany. In many cases, those places like Frankfurt, where Jermaine Jones is from, for instance, are very Americanized cities. And if you have the American dad and you grew up near a base, or you happen to be of African descent, like Jermaine Jones, like Fabian Johnson, like John Brooks, like all the rest. John Brooks grew up in Berlin, another city that's like that. You tend to kind of have some elements of American culture in your face, and you tend to be, even though you're in Germany, really part American. Maybe your footballing is very German, but your culture isn't. I think that's important to note with these dual nationals. They're not just maybe some of them are, but a number of them, like John Brooks, I think, is a great example, guys. He's a guy that grew up in Berlin, has never lived a day of his life in the United States, but he is an American, culturally. He absolutely is an American. So I wanted to point that out. So continue, Neil.
Yeah. No, Cameron Carter-Vickers, too.
Yeah, but that's another guy.
Because CCV wasn't the subject of a prolonged fight, and he isn't attached to Klinsmann, we don't think about him in the same terms as some of these other people. But if anything, because of the military link with some of these players that you've mentioned, if anything, we should be deferring to the military thing a little bit more. But go ahead, Neil. I'm sorry to interject there.
No. I mean, I think that the key phrase that you had initially made in the question was if it suits their development. And I think if you just add and is geographically reasonable to that, then, you know, I don't really have an issue with saying it would be great if a lot of the United States players that ultimately play for the senior team started in America or emerged from an academy, whether it be an MLS academy or somewhere else. And you know, I think that's fine and even good. And I think there's this trend, at least with MLS, where it's become an appealing league for young players from other countries, whether or not I forget who there was a tweet the other day that was like, it's appealing for other countries, but the percentages for young American players in terms of playing time are not great. You know, maybe that's something that can improve, but I don't know. I'd like Richard's take on this, because I've rambled too long while just sort of dodging the question.
Yeah, I think I remember that tweet. I wish I could remember how to pronounce his last name. His first name is Alex, and he actually showed the percentage of playing time that is going to domestic players under 20 years old, I think it was, in each of the top, like, 10 leagues plus MLS. And there were a couple of leagues that really stood out, like I think it was Portugal and the Netherlands that really stood out, where, like, 6 or 7% of the playing time in that league went to domestic players under 20 years old. And then MLS was near the bottom. But I also saw MLS wasn't really, didn't appear to be that different as, if you terms of like a standard deviation from most of the other major leagues.
Right.
Ligue 1 was the other one in the difference, in addition to the Netherlands, not Portland. But MLS was like eighth or ninth on this 10 or 11 league list, but it was at like 1.7, and fifth place on the list, I think, was Spain at 2.4 or something like that. I can't even remember.
Gotcha.
But, I mean, Spain is obviously heavily Spanish. It's just not heavily Spanish under 20 years old. Spain has so many good players that only a few younger players are breaking in. But, sorry, that was a tangent. So to get back on track here, one of the things that I find most annoying about a lot of the conversations that end up defining our soccer culture is the lack of provability. So the most obvious one here is promotion relegation, where you can say whatever you want about promotion and relegation, and a lot of the theories I don't dismiss or buy into, but it's none of it is provable. You're not going to have this natural experiment. One way to prove it would be to divide our country in half, and half of the country does promotion relegation and the other half doesn't, and then we'll see in 25 years which part of the country is developing better players. That's never going to happen, and unless it does, we're not going to be able to prove this pro-rel thing as in terms of player development, things like that, or in terms of building soccer culture. So when we're talking about hypotheticals like the one Arctic espoused that a lot of people continue to go back to, it's pretty much unprovable. Because even if our country switched to where we started prioritizing all that, we still don't have a national side-by-side experiment. All you would be doing is comparing the current situation going forward to the past, and things in this country evolve so quickly in soccer that that's not a very fair comparison. I tend to think that, you know, if you wanted to do that, I think it would be very interesting, but it would be inherently unfair to a lot of people. You know, we do see some kind of natural experiments out there that kind of naturally happen. Like in Spain, we have enough reason to think that the prospects that come from La Masia tend to be better prospects than we see elsewhere. And the same thing with the Ajax Academy in the Netherlands. But then conversely, in Germany, we don't see that Bayern is producing so many better prospects than the other teams in Germany. So probably why Bayern's Academy isn't quite on the same level. I think that in a world where these things are generally going to be improvable, it's probably best for us to talk about the problems that we can solve, or addressing the actual state of the world, and not trying to fabricate a hypothetical one that we can never actually implement. And the only other example I want to bring up is Michael Bradley. And again, this gets into the problem of Michael Bradley went to the Netherlands so long ago that it's almost foolish to bring him up because that world is so different now. But Michael Bradley went to the Netherlands, I think, at 19. He obviously was a product of concerted effort within U.S. soccer, and he's probably one of the top five players that U.S. soccer has ever produced. Can we say for sure, based on his example, that people should be going to the Netherlands at that age? Well, no, we can't say for sure. We can't eliminate the possibility either, because he's one guy. He's obviously a very special player. And again, well, not again, but in addition, like, is that the line that we should be drawing on this? Do people need to be going at 19, 21, 17, 15?
So we have two examples of this, Richard. The two best passing midfielders, two most cultured midfielders, for the use of a kind of a lazy term maybe, that we've had that have not been of Latin origin in the history of this U.S. soccer program, where John O'Brien and Michael Bradley both went to the Netherlands at a very young age. Is that enough data for us to come to the conclusion? I'm not sure it is, but at the same time, I don't think we can dismiss it either and say that those are outliers or just one-offs. We just don't have enough information yet.
And maybe it's like, I think Neil might have said this, or you said it in this conversation, maybe we're just going to have to accept that each of these situations is different, and we're going to have to weigh the merits of them based on the factors in these players' life or the factors in this player's development, and not try to sit here and pretend like there's one big answer for anything. And for me, that kind of suits the realities of our country. We're always going to be a big country. We're always going to be diverse. We're always going to be seeing prospects pop up from here, there, and legitimately, given the expanse of the military, everywhere. So we need to have a federation that's flexible. We need to have a federation that's open-minded. We need to have a federation that's resourceful. And I think, I don't know if you guys agree with me, but I'm not exactly sure that there's been any time in my soccer fandom where our federation has truly checked all three of those boxes.
No, I don't think it has. And I want to bring this up, kind of close at least what my thoughts are on this. here, which is that, so one thing that this whole thing has got me thinking about is what the Federation's role needs to be in increasing access to underserved and marginalized communities. And so this is kind of the strange circuitry in my brain. But what it got me thinking about was the She Believes Cup and this sort of celebration of this has been a flawed at times, you know, Federation as it relates to women's soccer, but also one that I think has a lot to celebrate in terms of the way it has supported women's soccer. So the She Believes Cup is sort of this event that speaks to that, at least the good and positive part of it. So what should the Federation's role be, you know, in terms of what the Federation believes towards underserved communities, particularly communities dominated by the rural poor and people of color? I think that is a really significant, if not the significant, question facing the Federation as it relates to the men's game and the women's game in the next decade. But I think more specifically the men's game, because the women's game, you could do several podcasts on the questions facing the Federation in that front. But, you know, what role is it? Is it a role where you see corporate partnerships to increase access on the financial side? Is it a role where you place specific demands on clubs in terms of what their partnerships and community cooperatives are towards underserved communities? I mean, what do you do? Is it both? Is it a, you know, just throw the kitchen sink at the problem type of thing? So I think that those are the sorts of solutions that whoever becomes the new leader actually has to face. And it's one reason why I've pushed back a little bit on this, oh, this election doesn't matter kind of dialogue, because I do think it does, at least because there's a voice in that boardroom that says, look, this is a problem. We need some solutions to address it. How do we want to approach that problem in a way that is productive and gets more kids playing the game? Forget what they become, because the chances of any of them making the national team, as you all know, I mean, that's so far down the road. We need them playing soccer, and we need them playing soccer in facilities that are decent and with coaches that care.
Yeah, well, I agree with all of that, Neil, and I would add this. I think even if they don't make the national team, this is something that isn't being talked about much. I think maybe you, Richard, and your colleagues at 442 had talked about it slightly. There is now a growing percentage of – and I see the number increasing every year. We're not at Premier League levels yet, but a growing number of foreign players or players who were eligible for foreign national teams playing in Major League Soccer. So we're not even producing enough players to fill out MLS. And this is happening to a lesser extent at the USL and NASL level also, to fill out MLS, USL, NASL squads. And then we've got potentially new pro leagues in NISA and the USL D3 league. So I think player development and mining those poor communities and communities of color is going to be essential for even sustaining the professional club game in this country much longer in a way that has not really been talked about maybe as aggressively or as openly as it needs to be.
Yeah, I think that one of the frustrating things about this election, the U.S. soccer presidential election, is kind of the same thing that is frustrating when people only focus on some of the issues that we only focused on in the first, 40 minutes of this podcast or something like that.
Right.
I mean, hopefully people don't tune into podcasts like these and assume that they are the biggest issues facing U.S. soccer, because they're just the highest profile ones, because they involve players that are on our television sets and they involve players that we pay jerseys for. But I think that people, particularly at the time of this presidential election, really need to think about what they want their federation to do. Of course, you know, we want us to have national teams and things like that. Those are all great. But for me, I want a soccer federation that provides the most access to the most soccer for the most people. And what I mean by that is that it's giving everybody in this country some kind of outlet to pursue soccer. And if you're a good player, it's providing outlets for you to improve. And if you're an even better player, it's providing structures at professional level for you to make your living in soccer. And I think for the most part, on those goals, we're pretty good. We're doing pretty good. You look at the growth of Major League Soccer. You look at how many more Division II teams we have now as opposed to 15 years ago. You look at how many investors want to get involved in the games at those levels. It's all pretty good. You even look at the youth level. We're pay to play is a major problem. But at the same time, we have mechanisms at that level that, while they need to be tweaked, are going in the right direction. So when we're sitting here talking in these presidential elections about pro rel or, oh, MLS should be doing this, or why is the national team this, I think those are very far down the list of my priorities when I think about what a federation should be doing and what the president should be advocating. Now let's bring it back to the conversation we just had. How, if you were to put a percentage on the amount of amount of people in this country that U.S. soccer adequately serves, what would that percentage be to you guys? I think we can say that almost all the inner cities of this country are unserved. I think the places that tend to be economically disadvantaged tend to be underserved. We talk all the time about how U.S. soccer has no meaningful outreach into the Hispanic community. What percentage of the country do you think is being properly served by U.S. soccer?
And so many of the Hispanics and African Americans that end up in the system are from suburban areas.
Right, exactly. I mean, basically, only the suburban areas of this country are being adequately served by U.S. soccer, in my opinion. You go to the poorest parts of this country or the most urban parts of this country, unfortunately sometimes those aren't different, but you go to the most urban parts of this country, U.S. soccer doesn't want to spend the money to build futsal courts in the middle of these cities when it has this huge surplus and can access so many people with those. In the most rural parts of this country, they don't have the scouting networks, the outreach to really go out there. And, you know, everybody knows stories like Mickey Mantle's on the baseball side back in the 40s, where the Yankees had scouting networks extending into Oakland, freaking Homa to find Mickey Mantle. I'm not saying that, you know, U.S. soccer should be the New York Yankees. Actually, I'm saying they should be better than the New York Yankees at this stuff. There should be a part of this country where the federation, as endorsed by the Olympic Committee to run this soccer in this country, should be overlooking. So even this discussion that we started this podcast with one person, one player, electing to play for Mexico as opposed to the United States, I think that's an incredibly interesting conversation. But when people are thinking about soccer in this country, I hope they're thinking as much about the people in their community as they are the people that are on their television sets. And to be honest with you, I just don't think that they are.
That's a great place to leave it, guys. Thanks for joining us. This is going to be a discussion that continues for years to come, irrespective of who wins the presidential election next month in Orlando. Believe it or not, U.S. soccer fans, that will not solve everything if your preferred candidate wins. We have a lot of heavy lifting to do and a lot of hard work to do. So Neil and I will be back real soon with another profile with a candidate running for U.S. soccer president. Richard, where can folks find you on social media?
They can follow me at Richard Farley on Twitter, and as we alluded to at the beginning of the show, in a couple of weeks people will know where I'm working again, but for now, if you reach out to me there, I would love to talk to people and occupy my time during this down period. I was going to talk to you guys up air about this, but I've been so bored during this month transition between jobs that I went out and bought an old Xbox 360 just so I could play the old EA NCAA basketball, NCAA football games that are no longer out.
Oh, so good.
Oh, those are so good.
Yeah, it's a shame that we can't have those. Well, I say actually very supportive of what Ed O'Bannon did.
Yeah, I was about to say.
but I know both of you are big into college football and college basketball. And yeah. I've just been spending my days here. I don't even actually play the games. I just go through the simulations and do the recruiting and set up the strategies and the playbooks and just run season.
Yeah, the college football game was really good. I'll give you that. But I think for college basketball, you want to go back and get the 2K Sports college basketball games. They were better than the EA games. The March Madness game wasn't as good as the 2K. Boy, I can't even remember what the 2K college hoops games was called.
I think it was just called March Madness.
Oh, no, that was EA.
It's called College Hoops.
College Hoops, that's right. Like, yeah, those were even better.
Yeah. I am going to do that because I just played my first 30 seasons with the March Madness one. It's March Madness 2008, so people will know. Kevin Durant is on the cover of it. That's how it's Kevin Durant in a Texas uniform is on the cover of it.
That's amazing.
So, yeah. So I took the University of Portland to 6 national championships, I'm proud to say. 5 years into it, we were so good that we put it into the Pac-10. And it was amazing. And my favorite season was the year that we went all the way to the final to play an undefeated UNLV team and beat them in the final. So, I mean, that's nostalgic for people my age just because of that one awesome UNLV team that lost in the semifinal to Duke that one year. But that's what I've been doing over the last month. So if anybody wants to talk to me about video games, too, that's really where my professional interests lie for 2 more weeks.
Well, maybe we can get you playing Football Manager in the next few weeks with the U.S. Men's National Team and see how far you can take them.
Yeah, let's do the natural experiment of having one save where Jonathan Gonzalez is with the team and one where he's not with the team.
Right. Which you can do in Football Manager, actually. You know, you have one save where you cap him and one save where you don't select him and he ends up on Mexico. I guarantee you that'll happen. Great idea. So for those of you out there,
Did you come up with the ratings 1 year on Football Manager, or am I?
Yeah, I did. I did for a couple years, actually. For U.S.-based players. So that's a little bit of nugget of my history for those of you listening. Anyway,
you're the reason Mikel Arteta was one of the best players in the Premier League.
Yeah, actually, the Everton guys, I did kind of bump up when I think about it, because I was in love with that particular team. Might have actually Pinar too. That might have been why his pace was like off the charts. But anyway, guys, we'll be back. Neil and I will be back soon. Thanks again to Richard, and thank you for listening.